you die in the interrogator's office, they'll tell your relatives you've been sentenced to camp without the right of correspondence, and then just let them look for you. If you are an orthodox communist, then another orthodox communist will sidle up to you, peering about with hostile suspicion, and he'll begin to whisper in your ear so that the uninitiated cannot overhear, "It's our duty to support Soviet interrogation. It's a combat situation. We ourselves are to blame. We were too soft-hearted. And now look at all the rot that is multiplied in the country. There is a vicious secret war going on. Even here we are surrounded by enemies. Just listen to what they are saying. The party is not obliged to account for what it does to every single one of us, to explain the whys and wherefores. If they ask us to, that means we should sign." And another orthodox communist sidles up. "I signed denunciations against 35 people, against all my acquaintances, and I advise you too, drag along as many names as you can in your wake, as many as you can. That way it will become obvious that the whole thing is an absurdity, and they'll let everyone out." But that is precisely what the organs need, the conscientiousness of the orthodox communist and the purpose of the NKVD naturally coincide. Indeed, the NKVD needs just that arched fan of names, that fat multiplication of them. That is the mark of the quality of their work, and these are also new patches of woods in which to set out snares. "Your accomplices! Accomplices! Others who share your views!" That is what they kept pressing to shake out of everyone. They say that R. Ralloff named Cardinal Richelieu as one of his accomplices, and that the cardinal was, in fact, so listed in his depositions. And no one was astonished by this until Ralloff was questioned about it at his rehabilitation proceedings in 1956. Apropos of the orthodox communists, Stalin was necessary for such a purge as that, yes, but a party like that was necessary too. The majority of those in power, up to the very moment of their own arrest, were pitiless in arresting others, obediently destroyed their peers in accordance with those same instructions, and handed over to retribution any friend or comrade-in-arms of yesterday. And all the big Bolsheviks, who now wear martyrs' halos, managed to be the executioners of other Bolsheviks, not even taking into account how all of them, in the first place, had been the executioners of non-communists. Perhaps 1937 was needed in order to show how little their whole ideology was worth, that ideology of which they boasted so enthusiastically, turning Russia upside down, destroying its foundations, trampling everything it held sacred underfoot, that Russia where they themselves had never been threatened by such retribution. The victims of the Bolsheviks from 1918 to 1946 never conducted themselves so despicably as the leading Bolsheviks when the lightning struck them. If you study in detail the whole history of the arrests and trials of 1936 to 1938, the principal revulsion you feel is not against Stalin and his accomplices, but against the humiliatingly repulsive defendants, nausea at their spiritual baseness after their former pride and implacability. So what is the answer? How can you stand your ground when you are weak and sensitive to pain, when people you love are still alive, when you are unprepared? What do you need to make you stronger than the interrogator and the whole trap? From the moment you go to prison, you must put your cozy past firmly behind you. At the very threshold, you must say to yourself, "My life is over, a little early to be sure, but there's nothing to be done about it. I shall never return to freedom. I am condemned to die. Now, or a little later. But later on, in truth, it will be even harder, and so the sooner the better. I no longer have any property whatsoever. For me, those I love have died, and for them I have died. From today on, my body is useless and alien to me. Only my spirit and my conscience remain precious and important to me." Confronted by such a prisoner, the interrogation will tremble. Only the man who has renounced everything can win that victory. But how can one turn one's body to stone? Well, they managed to turn some individuals from the Berdyaev circle into puppets for a trial, but they didn't succeed with Berdyaev, They wanted to drag him into an open trial. They arrested him twice. And in 1922, he was subjected to a night interrogation by Dzerzhinsky himself. Kamenev was there too, which means that he too was not averse to using the Cheka in an ideological conflict. But Berdyaev did not humiliate himself. He did not beg or plead. He set forth firmly those religious and moral principles which had led him to refuse to accept the political authority established in Russia. And not only did they come to the conclusion that he would be useless for a trial, but they liberated him. A human being has a point of view. N. Stolyarova recalls an old woman who was her neighbor on the Butyrki bunks in 1937. They kept on interrogating her every night. 2 years earlier, a former metropolitan of the Orthodox Church, who had escaped from exile, had spent a night at her home on his way through Moscow. But he wasn't the former metropolitan. He was the metropolitan. Truly, I was worthy of receiving him. All right, then. To whom did he go when he left Moscow? I know, but I won't tell you. The metropolitan had escaped to Finland via an underground railroad of believers. At first, the interrogators took turns, and then they went after her in groups. They shook their fists in the little old woman's face, and she replied, "There is nothing you can do with me, even if you cut me into pieces. After all, you are afraid of your bosses, and you are afraid of each other, and you are even afraid of killing me." They would lose contact with the Underground Railroad. "But I am not afraid of anything. I would be glad to be judged by God right this minute." There were such people in 1937, too. People who did not return to their cell for their bundles of belongings, who chose death, who signed nothing denouncing anyone. One can't say that the history of the Russian revolutionaries has given us any better examples of steadfastness. But there is no comparison anyway, because none of our revolutionaries ever knew what a really good interrogation could be, with 52 different methods to choose from. Sheshkovsky did not subject Radishchev to torture, and because of contemporary custom, Radishchev knew perfectly well that his sons would serve as officers in the Imperial Guard, no matter what happened to him, and that their lives wouldn't be cut short. Nor would anyone confiscate Radishchev's family estate. Nonetheless, in the course of his brief 2-week interrogation, this outstanding man renounced his beliefs and his book and begged for mercy. Nicholas I didn't have enough imagination to arrest the wives of the Decembrists and compel them to scream in the interrogation room next door, or even to torture the Decembrists themselves. But in any case, he didn't need to. Even Ryleyev answered fully, frankly, and hid nothing. Even Pestel broke down and named comrades, who were still free, assigned to bury Ruskaya Pravda and the very place where it had been buried. In part, the reason for this was the same as in the case of Bukharin many years later. They were, after all, being interrogated by their social equals, their class brothers, and so their desire to explain everything was only natural. There were very few who, like Lunin, expressed disdain and contempt for the investigating commission. The majority behaved badly and got one another more deeply involved. Many of them begged abjectly to be pardoned. Zavalishin put all the blame on Ryleyev. Y.P. Obolensky and S.P. Trubetskoy couldn't wait to slander Griboyedov, which even Nicholas I didn't believe. Bakunin, in his confessions, abjectly grovelled before Nicholas I, thereby avoiding execution. Was this wretchedness of soul or revolutionary cunning? One would think that those who decided to assassinate Alexander II must have been people of the highest selflessness and dedication. After all, they knew what the stakes were. Grinevitsky shared the fate of the Tsar, but Rysakov remained alive and was held for interrogation. And that very day he blabbed on the participants in the plot and identified their secret meeting places. Out of fear for his young life, he rushed to give the government more information than he could ever have been suspected of having. He nearly choked with repentance. He proposed to expose all the secrets of the anarchists. At the end of the last century and the beginning of this one, the Tsarist interrogator immediately withdrew his question if the prisoner found it inappropriate or too intimate. But in Kresty prison in 1938, when the old political hard labor prisoner Zelensky was whipped with ramrods with his pants pulled down like a small boy, he wept in his cell. "My Tsarist interrogator didn't even dare address me rudely." Or, for example, we learn from recently published research that the Tsarist gendarme seized the manuscript of Lenin's essay, "What Are Our Ministers Thinking Of?", but were unable to get at its author. At the interrogation, the gendarmes, just as one might have expected, learned very little from the student Vanayev. The italics here and throughout the quotation are my own. He informed them only that the manuscripts found at his place had been brought to him in one package for safekeeping several days before the search by a certain person whom he did not wish to name. Therefore, the interrogator's sole alternative was to turn the manuscripts over for expert analysis. The experts learned nothing. What did he mean, his sole alternative? What about icy water up to the ankles, or a saltwater douche? Or Ryumin's truncheon. It would seem that the author of this article, R. Peresvetov, himself served time for several years and might easily have enumerated what alternatives the interrogator actually had when confronting the guardian of Lenin's "What Are Our Ministers Thinking Of?". As S.P. Melgunov recollects, that was a Tsarist prison, a prison of blessed memory, which political prisoners nowadays can only recall with a feeling almost of gladness. But that is a case of displaced concepts. The yardstick is totally different. Just as ox-cart drivers of Gogol's time could not have imagined the speed of a jet plane, those who have never gone through the receiving line meat grinder of Gulag cannot grasp the true possibilities of interrogation. We read in Izvestia for May the 24th, 1959, that Yulipa Rumyantseva was confined in the internal prison of a Nazi camp while they tried to find out from her the whereabouts of her husband, who had escaped from that same camp. She knew, but she refused to tell. For a reader who is not in the know, this is a model of heroism. For a reader with a bitter gulag past, it's a model of inefficient interrogation. Yulia did not die under torture, and she was not driven insane. A month later, she was simply released, still very much alive and kicking. All these thoughts about standing firm as a rock were quite unknown to me in February 1945. Not only was I not in the least prepared to cut my cozy ties with Earth, I was even quite angry for a long time because 100 or so Faber pencils had been taken away from me when I was arrested. Looking back on my interrogation from my long subsequent imprisonment, I had no reason to be proud of it. I might have borne myself more firmly, and in all probability I could have maneuvered more skillfully. But my first weeks were characterized by a mental blackout and a slump into depression. The only reason these recollections do not torment me with remorse is that, thanks be to God, I avoided getting anyone else arrested, but I came close to it. Although we were frontline officers, Nikolai V. and I, who were involved in the same case, got ourselves into prison through a piece of childish stupidity. He and I corresponded during the war between two sectors of the front, and though we knew perfectly well that wartime censorship of correspondence was in effect, we indulged in fairly outspoken expressions of our political outrage and in derogatory comments about the wisest of the wise, whom we labelled with the transparently obvious nickname of Pakan, or ringleader of the thieves. When, later on, I reported our case in various prisons, our naivete aroused only laughter and astonishment. Other prisoners told me that two more such stupid jackasses couldn't exist, and I became convinced of it myself. Then, suddenly, one day, reading some documents on the case of Alexander Ulyanov, Lenin's elder brother, I learned that he and his confederates got caught in exactly the same way, a careless exchange of letters. And that was the only reason Alexander III didn't die on March the 1st, 1887. A member of the group, Andriushkin, sent a frank letter to his friend in Kharkov. I am firmly convinced that we are going to have the most merciless terror, and in the fairly near future, too. Red terror is my hobby. I am worried about my addressee. If he gets it, then I may get it, too, and that would be unfortunate, because I will drag in a lot of very effective people. It was not the first such letter he had written, and the unhurried search this letter initiated continued for 5 weeks, via Kharkov, in order to discover who in St. Petersburg had written it. Andreyushkin's identity was not established until February the 28th. On March the 1st, the bomb throwers, bombs in hand, were arrested on Nevsky Prospect just before the attempted assassination. The office of my interrogator, I.I. Yetsepov, was high-ceilinged, spacious and bright, with an enormous window. The Rossiya Insurance Company had not been built with torture in mind. And, putting to use its 17 feet of height, a full-length, vertical, 13-foot portrait of that powerful sovereign hung there, toward whom I, grain of sand that I was, had expressed my hatred. Sometimes the interrogator stood in front of the portrait and declaimed dramatically, "We are ready to lay down our lives for him. We are ready to lay down in the path of oncoming tanks for his sake." Face to face with the altar-like grandeur of that portrait, my mumbling about some kind of purified Leninism seemed pitiful, and I myself seemed a blasphemous slanderer deserving only death. The contents of our letters provided more than enough, in keeping with the standards of those times, to sentence us both. Therefore my interrogator did not have to invent anything. He merely tried to cast his noose around everyone I had ever written to or received a letter from. I had expressed myself vehemently in letters to friends my own age, and had been almost reckless in spelling out seditious ideas, but my friends, for some reason, had continued to correspond with me. And some suspicious phrases could be found in their replies to my letters. One of our school friends was nearly arrested because of me at this time. It was an enormous relief to me to learn later that he was still free. But then, 22 years later, he wrote to me, "On the basis of your published works, I conclude that you take a one-sided view of life. Objectively speaking, you have become the standard-bearer of fascist reactionaries in the West, in West Germany and the United States, for example. Lenin, whom I'm convinced you love and honor just as much as you used to, yes, and old Marx and Engels, too, would have condemned you in the severest fashion. Think about that." Indeed, I do think about that. How sorry I am that you didn't get arrested then. How much you lost. And then Yezepov, like Porfiry Petrovich, demanded that I explain it all in a coherent way. If we had expressed ourselves in such a fashion in letters that we knew were subject to censorship, what could we have said to each other face to face? I could not convince him that all my fire-eating talk was confined to my letters. And at that point, with muddled mind, I had to undertake to weave something credible about my meetings with my friends, meetings referred to in my letters. What I said had to jibe with the letters in such a way as to be on the very edge of political matters, and yet not fall under that criminal code. Moreover, these explanations had to pour forth quickly, all in one breath, so as to convince this veteran interrogator of my naivete, my humility, my total honesty. The main thing was not to provoke my lazy interrogator to any interest in looking through that accursed load of stuff I had brought in my accursed suitcase, including many notebooks of my war diary, written in hard, light pencil, in a needle-thin handwriting, with some of the notes already partially washed out. These diaries constituted my claim to becoming a writer. I had not believed in the capacities of our amazing memory, and throughout the war years I had tried to write down everything I saw. That would have been only half a catastrophe. I also wrote down everything I heard from other people. But opinions and stories which were so natural in front-line areas seemed to be treasonable here in the rear, and reeked of raw imprisonment for my front-line comrades. So, to prevent that interrogator from going to work on my war diary and mining from it a whole case against a free front-line tribe, I repented just as much as I had to, and pretended to see the light and reject my political mistakes. I became utterly exhausted from this balancing on a razor's edge, until I recognized that no one was being hauled in for a confrontation with me, and distinguished the clear signs that the interrogation was drawing to an end. Until, in the fourth month, all the notebooks of my war diary were cast into the hellish maw of the Lubyanka furnace, where they burst into flame, the red pyre of one more novel which had perished in Russia, and flew out of the highest chimney in black butterflies of soot. We used to walk in the shadow of that chimney, our exercise yard, a box-like concrete enclosure on the roof of the big Lubyanka, 6 floors up. The walls rose around us to approximately 3 times a man's height. With our own ears, we could hear Moscow automobile horns honking back and forth. But all we could see was that chimney, the guard posted in a 7th-floor tower, and that segment of God's heaven whose unhappy fate it was to float over the Lubyanka. Oh, that soot! It kept falling on and on in that first post-war May. So much of it fell during each of our walks that we decided the Lubyanka must be burning countless years of files. My doomed diary was only one momentary plume of that soot. I recalled a frosty, sunny morning in March when I was sitting in the interrogator's office. He was asking his customary crude questions and writing down my answers, distorting my words as he did so. The sun played in the melting latticework of the frost on the wide window, through which at times I felt very much like jumping, so as to flash through Moscow at least in death and smash onto the sidewalk 5 floors below, just as, in my childhood, my unknown predecessor had jumped from House 33 in Rostov-on-the-Don. In the gaps where the frost had melted, the rooftops of Moscow could be seen, rooftop after rooftop, and above them merry little puffs of smoke. But I was staring not in that direction, but at a mound of piled-up manuscripts, someone else's, covering the entire center of the floor in this half-empty room, 36 square yards in area. Manuscripts which had been dumped there a little while before and had not yet been examined. In notebooks, in file folders, in homemade binders, in tied and untied bundles, and simply in loose pages. The manuscripts lay there like the burial mound of some interred human spirit, its conical top rearing higher than the interrogator's desk, almost blocking me from his view. And brotherly pity ached in me for the labor of that unknown person who had been arrested the previous night, these spoils from the search of his premises having been dumped that very morning on the parquet floor of the torture chamber, at the feet of that 13-foot Stalin. I sat there and I wondered, whose extraordinary life had they brought in for torment, for dismemberment, and then for burning? Oh, how many ideas and works had perished in that building, a whole lost culture? Oh, soot, soot, from the Lubyanka chimneys. And the most hurtful thing of all was that our descendants would consider our generation more stupid, less gifted, less vocal, than in actual fact it was. One needs to have only 2 points in order to draw a straight line between them. In 1920, as Ehrenberg recalls, the checker addressed him as follows. You prove to us that you are not Rangel's agent. And in 1950, one of the leading colonels of the MGB, former Fomich Zelenov, said to his prisoners, We are not going to sweat to prove the prisoner's guilt to him. Let him prove to us that he did not have hostile intent. And along this cannibalistically artless straight line lie the recollections of countless millions. What a speed-up and simplification of criminal investigation previously unknown to mankind. The organs altogether freed themselves of the burden of obtaining proof. Trembling and pale, the rabbit who had been caught, deprived of the right to write anyone, phone anyone, bring anything with him from freedom, deprived, too, of sleep, food, paper, pencils, and even Buttons, seated on a bare stool in the corner of an office, had to try to find out for himself and display to that loafer of an interrogator proof that he did not have hostile intentions. If he could not discover such proof, and where would he find it? By that very failure, he provided the interrogation with approximate proof of his guilt. I knew of a case in which a certain old man who had been a prisoner in Germany managed, nonetheless, sitting there on his bare stool and gesturing with his cold fingers, to prove to his monster of an interrogator that he did not betray his motherland, and even that he did not have any such intention. It was a scandal. And what happened? Did they free him? Of course not. After all, he told me about this in Butyrki, and not on Tverskoy Boulevard in the middle of Moscow. At that point, a second interrogator joined the first, and they spent a quiet evening reminiscing with the old man. Then the two interrogators signed witnesses' affidavits, stating that in the course of the evening, the hungry, sleepy old man had engaged in anti-Soviet propaganda. Things were said innocently, but they weren't listened to innocently. The old man was then turned over to a third interrogator, who quashed the treason indictment and neatly nailed him with that very same tenor for anti-Soviet agitation during his interrogation. Given that interrogations had ceased to be an attempt to get at the truth, for the interrogators in difficult cases, they became a mere exercise of their duties as executioners, and in easy cases simply a pastime and a basis for receiving a salary. And easy cases always existed, even in the notorious year 1937. For example, Borodko was accused of having visited his parents in Poland 16 years before without having a passport for foreign travel. His papa and mama lived all of 10 versts, 6 miles away, but the diplomats had signed away that part of Byelorussia to Poland, and in 1921 people had not yet gotten used to that fact and went back and forth as they pleased. The interrogation took just half an hour. Question. Did you go there? Answer. I did. Question. How? Answer. Horseback, of course. Conclusion. Take 10 years for KRD. But that sort of pace smells of the Stakhanovite movement, a movement which found no disciples among the Blue Caps. According to the Code of Criminal Procedure, every interrogation was supposed to take 2 months. And if it presented difficulties, one was allowed to ask the prosecutor for several continuations of a month apiece, which, of course, the prosecutors never refused. Thus, it would have been stupid to risk one's health, not to take advantage of these postponements, and, speaking in factory terms, to raise one's work norms. Having worked with voice and fist in the initial assault week of every interrogation, and thereby expended one's will and character, as per Vyshinsky, the interrogators had a vital interest in dragging out the remainder of every case as long as possible. That way, more old, subdued cases were on hand, and fewer new ones. It was considered just indecent to complete a political interrogation in 2 months. The state system itself suffered from its own lack of trust and from its rigidity. These interrogators were selected personnel, but they weren't trusted either. In all probability, they, too, were required to check in on arriving and check out on leaving, and the prisoners were, of course, checked in and out when called for questioning. What else could the interrogators do to keep the bookkeeper's accounts straight? They would summon one of their defendants, sit him down in a corner, ask him some terrifying question, and then forget about him while they themselves sat for a long time reading the paper, writing an outline for a political indoctrination course, or personal letters, or went off to visit one another, leaving guards to act as watchdogs in their place. Peacefully batting the breeze on the sofa with a colleague who had just dropped in, the interrogator would come to himself once in a while, look threateningly at the accused, and say, "Now, there's a rat. There's a real rat for you. Well, that's all right. We'll not be stingy about his 9 grams. My interrogator also made frequent use of the telephone. For example, he used to phone home and tell his wife, with his sparkling eyes directed at me, that he was going to be working all night long, so she mustn't expect him before morning. My heart, of course, fell. That meant he would be working me over all night long. But then he would immediately dial the phone number of his mistress, and in purring tones make a date with her for the night. So I would be able to get some sleep. I felt relieved. Thus it was that the faultless system was moderated only by the shortcomings of those who carried it out. Certain of the more curious interrogators used to enjoy using empty interrogations to broaden their knowledge of life. They might ask the accused prisoner about the front, about those very German tanks beneath which they never quite managed to find the time to throw themselves. or perhaps about the customs of European countries and lands across the sea which the prisoner had visited, about the stores and the merchandise sold in them, and particularly about procedures in foreign whorehouses, and about all kinds of adventures with women. The Code of Criminal Procedure provided that the prosecutor was to review continuously the course of every interrogation to ensure its being conducted correctly. But no one in our time ever saw him face to face until the so-called questioning by the prosecutor, which meant the interrogation was nearing its end. I, too, was taken to such a questioning. Lieutenant Colonel Kotov, a calm, well-nourished, impersonal blonde man, who was neither nasty nor nice, but essentially a cipher, sat behind his desk and, yawning, examined for the first time the file on my case. He spent 15 minutes acquainting himself with it while I watched. Since this questioning was quite unavoidable, and since it was also recorded, there would have been no sense at all in his studying the file at some earlier, unrecorded time, and then having had to remember details of the case for a certain number of hours. Finally, he raised his indifferent eyes to stare at the wall, and asked lazily what I wanted to add to my testimony. He was required by law to ask what complaints I had about the conduct of the interrogation, and whether coercion had been used, or any violations of my legal rights had occurred. But it had been a long time since prosecutors asked such questions, and what if they had? After all, the existence of that entire ministry building with its thousands of rooms, and of all 5,000 of the ministry's other interrogation buildings, railroad cars, caves, and dugouts scattered throughout the Soviet Union, was based on violations of legal rights. And it certainly wasn't up to Lieutenant Colonel Kotov and me to reverse that whole process. Anyway, all the prosecutors of any rank at all held their positions with the approval of that very same state security which they were supposed to check up on. His own wilted state, his lack of combativeness, and his fatigue from all those endless stupid cases were somehow transmitted to me, so I didn't raise questions of truth with him. I requested only that one too obvious stupidity be corrected. Two of us had been indicted in the same case, but our interrogations were conducted in different places, mine in Moscow and my friend's at the front. Therefore, I was processed singly, yet charged under Section 11. In other words, as a group, an organization. As persuasively as possible, I requested him to cancel this additional charge under Section 11. He leafed through the case for another 5 minutes, sighed, spread out his hands, and said, "What's there to say? One person is a person, and two persons are people." "But one person and a half? Is that an organization?" And he pushed the button for them to come and take me away. Soon after that, late one evening in late May, in that same office with the sculptured bronze clock on the marble mantel, my interrogator summoned me for a 206 procedure. This was, in accordance with the provisions of the Code of Criminal Procedure, the defendant's review of the case before his final signature. Not doubting for one moment that I would sign, the interrogator was already seated, writing the conclusion of the indictment. I opened the cover of the thick file, and there on the inside of the cover in printed text, I read an astonishing statement. It turned out that during the interrogation I had had the right to make written complaints against anything improper in its conduct, and that the interrogator was obliged to staple these complaints into my record. During the interrogation, not at its end. Alas, not one of the thousands with whom I was later imprisoned had been aware of this right. I turned more pages, I saw photocopies of my own letters, and a totally distorted interpretation of their meaning by unknown commentators, like Captain Libin. I saw the hyperbolized lie in which Captain Yezepov had wrapped up my careful testimony. And, last but not least, I saw the idiocy whereby I, one individual, was accused as a group. "I won't sign," I said, without much firmness. "You conducted the interrogation improperly." "All right, then let's begin it all over again." Maliciously, he compressed his lips. "We'll send you off to the place where we keep the Polizei." He even stretched out his hand as though to take the file away from me. At that point, I held on to it. Somewhere outside the fifth-floor windows of the Lubyanka, the golden sunset glowed. Somewhere, it was May. The office windows, like all the windows facing outward, were tightly closed and had not yet been unsealed after the winter, so that fresh air and the fragrance of things in bloom should not creep into those hidden rooms. The bronze clock on the mantel, from which the last rays of the sun had disappeared, quietly chimed. Begin all over again? It seemed to me it would be easier to die than to begin all over again. Ahead of me loomed at least some kind of life, if I had only known what kind. And then what about that place where they kept the Polizei? And in general, it was a bad idea to make him angry. It would influence the tone in which he phrased the conclusion of the indictment. And so I signed. I signed it complete with Section 11, the significance of which I did not then know. They told me only that it would not add to my prison term, but because of that Section 11, I was later put into a hard labor camp. Because of that Section 11, I was sent, even after liberation and without any additional sentence, into eternal exile. Maybe it was all for the best. Without both those experiences, I would not have written this book. My interrogator had used no methods on me other than sleeplessness, lies, and threats, all completely legal. Therefore, in the course of the 206 procedure, he didn't have to shove at me, as did interrogators who had made a mess of things and wanted to play safe, a document on non-disclosure for me to sign, that I, the undersigned, under pain of criminal penalty, swore never to tell anyone about the methods used in conducting my interrogation. No one knows, incidentally, what article of the code this comes under. In several of the provincial administrations of the NKVD, this measure was carried out in sequence. The typed statement on non-disclosure was shoved at a prisoner, along with the verdict of the OSO. And later, a similar document was shoved at prisoners being released from camp, whereby they guaranteed never to disclose to anyone the state of affairs in camp. And so, our habit of obedience, our bent or broken backbone, did not suffer us either to reject this gangster method of burying loose ends, or even to be enraged by it. We have lost the measure of freedom. We have no means of determining where it begins and where it ends. We are an Asiatic people. On and on and on they go, taking from us those endless pledges of non-disclosure. Everyone not too lazy to ask for them. By now, we are even unsure whether we have the right to talk about the events of our own lives. Chapter 4. The Blue Caps. Throughout the grinding of our souls in the gears of the great nighttime institution, when our souls are pulverized and our flesh hangs down in tatters like a beggar's rags, we suffer too much and are too immersed in our own pain to rivet with penetrating and far-seeing gaze those pale night executioners who torture us. A surfeit of inner grief floods our eyes. Otherwise, what historians of our torturers we would be, for it is certain they will never describe themselves as they actually are. But alas, every former prisoner remembers his own interrogation in detail, how they squeezed him, and what foulness they squeezed out of him. But often he does not even remember their names, let alone think about them as human beings. So it is with me. I can recall much more, and much more that's interesting, about any one of my cellmates than I can about Captain of State Security Yezepov, with whom I spent no little time face to face, the two of us alone in his office. There is one thing, however, which remains with us all as an accurate, generalized recollection. Foul rot, a space totally infected with putrefaction. And even when, decades later, we are long past fits of anger or outrage, in our own quieted hearts we retain this firm impression of low, malicious, impious, and possibly muddled people. There is an interesting story about Alexander II, the Tsar surrounded by revolutionaries, who were to make 7 attempts on his life. He once visited the House of Preliminary Detention on Shpalernaya, their uncle of the big house, where he ordered them to lock him up in solitary confinement cell number 227. He stayed in it for more than an hour, attempting thereby to sense the state of mind of those he had imprisoned there. One cannot but admit that for a monarch this was evidence of moral aspiration, to feel the need and make the effort to take a spiritual view of the matter. But it is impossible to picture any of our interrogators, right up to Abamukov and Beria, wanting to slip into a prisoner's skin even for 1 hour, or feeling compelled to sit and meditate in solitary confinement. Their branch of service does not require them to be educated people of broad culture and broad views, and they are not. Their branch of service does not require them to think logically, and they do not. Their branch of service requires only that they carry out orders exactly and be impervious to suffering. And that is what they do and what they are. We who have passed through their hands feel suffocated when we think of that legion which is stripped bare of universal human ideals. Although others might not be aware of it, it was clear to the interrogators at least that the cases were fabricated. Except at staff conferences, they could not seriously say to one another or to themselves that they were exposing criminals. Nonetheless, they kept right on producing depositions page after page to make sure that we rotted. So the essence of it all turns out to be the credo of the Blatni, the underworld of Russian thieves. You today, me tomorrow. They understood that the cases were fabricated, yet they kept on working year after year. How could they? Either they forced themselves not to think, and this in itself means the ruin of a human being, and simply accepted that this was the way it had to be, and that the person who gave them their orders was always right. But didn't the Nazis too, it comes to mind, argue that same way? There is no way of sidestepping this comparison. Both the years and the methods coincide too closely. And the comparison occurred even more naturally to those who had passed through the hands of both the Gestapo and the MGB. One of these was Yevgeny Ivanovich Divnich, an émigré and preacher of Orthodox Christianity. The Gestapo accused him of communist activities among Russian workers in Germany, and the MGB charged him with having ties to the international bourgeoisie. Divnich's verdict was unfavorable to the MGB. He was tortured by both, but the Gestapo was nonetheless trying to get at the truth, and when the accusation did not hold up, Divnich was released. The MGB wasn't interested in the truth, and had no intention of letting anyone out of its grip once he was arrested. Or else, it was a matter of the progressive doctrine, the granite ideology. An interrogator in awful Orutukan, sent there to the Kolyma in 1938 as a penalty assignment, was so touched when M. Luria, former director of the Krivoy Rog industrial complex, readily agreed to sign an indictment which meant a second camp term, that he used the time they had thus saved to say, "You think we get any satisfaction from using persuasion?" An affectionate term for torture. "We have to do what the party demands of us. You are an old party member. Tell me what you would do in my place." Apparently, Luria nearly agreed with him, and it may have been the fact that he had already been thinking in some such terms that led him to sign so readily. It is, after all, a convincing argument. But most often it was merely a matter of cynicism. The blue caps understood the workings of the meat grinder and loved it. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.